Hi, my name is Mark. I'm the Prepper Guy, and this is a Prepper Guy podcast. In a world that's always changing and full of fear and confusion, and especially when it comes to prepping, I am a minimalist, and I like to be ready for anything that life may throw at us, whether it's bad, the end of the world, or just a flat tire on a deserted road.
Hump day! Yeah!
Well, hello, everybody. This is Mark with Prepper Guy, and we're doing a third podcast on EMPs, and this one is more on the likelihood of an EMP and whether that is something that could affect our lives. We've talked about how we would deal with some of the violence during the aftermath and what the aftermath would look like, the some of the psychology or mindset we might have to acquire or train for, or at least get our head around after an EMP. But it seems to me that most people need to understand that it is a real threat, and it's not a conspiracy or voodoo science or something that could never possibly happen in America or any country. The technology is out there, and yet I see so many preppers in many communities saying that could never happen. I've talked to soldiers in the military and intelligence that say, well, I don't think it's that big of a threat. But what they're not factoring in is we can't test it. There's been some small test, and 100 years ago, there was the Carrington event. That was more of a solar flare, I guess, type situation. So many of us have this bubble that we don't want to try to peer through or maybe get out of, that an EMP could never happen. We would rather prep for economic collapse or zombie apocalypse than actually prep for something that is very real. And it's something that could happen quite easily. And most of our enemies have this capability. And yet there are still people out there in both government and in military intelligence and in the prepper community that say this cannot happen. So I thought I would edit some of the clip from Mark Levin's show where he has Dr. Peter Pry on, and this guy is an expert. So we're going to listen to a little bit of it, and then I'm going to talk a little bit here and there through the interview, because some of it gets off into other aspects that aren't as, I don't know, I would say poignant to EMP, even though that's what the whole subject is about. He does kind of go off into the weeds a little bit. So let's get going with the Mark Levin Life, Liberty, and Levin show and see if we can come up with some kind of sane rationale why we as preppers need to consider this as a very real threat that could affect our lives, our families' lives, and everyone we care about. And yet we try to put on blinders and blithely go through life thinking this one thing will never happen, when in actuality, it not only can, but it probably will. And so here we go.
Hello, America. I'm Mark Levin. This is Life, Liberty, and Levin. And we're here tonight to discuss an issue that I think is of grave importance. What happens if the electrical grid goes down? And is it easy to take it out? And who might take it out? And what can we do to protect it? This is a very, very important program as far as I'm concerned. So I've brought in the best who I can think of, Dr. Peter Pry. How are you, sir?
Thank you for having me, sir.
My honor. I consider you the foremost expert on this subject, and you've written widely about it. You've testified. You're the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, this electromagnetic pulse, EMP, and other threats on an accelerated basis. Director of the United States Nuclear Strategy Forum and Advisory Board to Congress on policies to counter weapons of mass destruction. You were an intelligence officer with the CIA, responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy and operational plans, including EMP threats. So let's begin at the beginning. What's EMP?
Well, electromagnetic pulse is basically a super energetic radio wave. It's got so much power that it can destroy electronics across the huge area. In fact, across the entire world, in the case of a superstorm, a solar superstorm, the EMP can be made by nature, by the sun, by a solar superstorm, or it can be made by man by a nuclear weapon, and it can be made by non-nuclear weapons as well. In the case of a sun, what we're concerned about is the once in a century, once every 150 years solar superstorm. We have geomagnetic storms that happen every year that affect countries at high northern latitudes. But once every century, 150 years ago is NASA's estimate, a superstorm will happen that will create an EMP that is so powerful that it can destroy electronics across the entire world and put billions of lives at risk.
Electromagnetic pulse.
Yes.
Is that what electricity does as it moves? What does that mean exactly?
Well, think of it this way. I think everybody has had the experience of driving down a highway with your radio on, and then you pass under a high power line and you lose the radio. Then you come up back out on the other side. That's basically all an EMP is. It's an electromagnetic field, all right? Except it's much more powerful than the field that you experience on the highway. Now imagine there's so much energy in that field that when you go through it, all the electronics in your car are destroyed. Now imagine that field is not just localized to a small spot on the highway, but it covers all of North America and it would destroy electronics across that entire area. That's what could be accomplished if you had a single nuclear weapon and detonated it above the atmosphere, say at 300 kilometers or so, up in outer space.
Mm-hmm.
Mind you, this is a different kind of nuclear attack than the one people are used to thinking about. It wouldn't destroy a city. There'd be no fallout. There'd be no blast effects. If you were standing on the ground directly beneath the explosion and it was detonating overhead at 300 kilometers, or it could be as low as 30 kilometers, it's in the vacuum of space, so that you wouldn't even hear the explosion. There'd be no blast effects that would reach the ground. There'd be no radioactive fallout.
Have we ever had one of these solar scenarios that you're talking about? You said every 100 or 150 years.
Yes, back in 1859, there was a solar superstorm that we call the Carrington event. And at that time, this was the electronics, the cutting edge electronics of the day. This was an 1859 telegraph key. The colonial powers had strung telegraph systems all over the world, in India, China, Africa, North America. We had them in North America. We just laid the transatlantic cable so that North America and Europe were connected for the first time. And when the pulse happened, it was so powerful, and I think even your viewers will be able to see this simple switch is, you know, really crude, made of heavy metal and all the rest. Telegraph keys like this were melted. The wooden base burst into flame. Telegraph stations burned down. The telegraph wires burst into flame and caused forest fires all over the world. The pulse was so powerful, it reached down miles deep into the Atlantic Ocean and burned the cable out and had to be replaced. Now, this didn't end civilization in 1859 because those were the horse and buggy days, and it wasn't yet an electronic civilization. You know, this was just cutting-edge technology, more or less a novelty. But today, you know, this simple switch, this biode, is the basis for our modern electronic civilization. You know, all of our computers, our control systems, your cell phones basically operate on that simple switch. And they are millions of times more vulnerable to EMP than this crude piece of instrumentation. And that would put our civilization at risk if we had a natural EMP from the sun like the solar superstorm, or if a nuclear EMP attack happened that put all of North America under that.
Okay, so during this interview, Mark Levin's going to ask him quite a few questions, and the next question coming up is on why our electrical grid is set up the way it is set up, and how it operates, and some of the equipment that is so susceptible, or I guess damageable, through these types of events, whether it's solar or nuclear. And so I think it's a good bit of information to pay attention to, to see just how our grid works and operates, and some of the key components that we rely on. And sometimes when we dismiss the fact that an EMP could happen, maybe in an overly optimistic way of looking at the world, that if it were to happen, why would it affect us so severely as an advanced nation? And why couldn't we just rebuild it and put it back together pretty quickly? And I think his take on this is pretty interesting. So let's listen to some more of this.
Electromagnetic
I want to get
field.
To these nuclear scenarios, these terrorist scenarios. But first, can you describe what the electrical grid looks like in this country and who runs the electrical grid in this country?
Sure. We have 3,000 different utilities that run the electric grid, which is privately owned. It's not run by the government. It's run by private
So these are companies or regional companies that all work with each other?
Yes, that's right. And we have a our North American grid is divided into three parts, an eastern grid, a western grid, and a Texas grid. And Canada is part of our grid. Canada is on the same part of our grid, part of the eastern and western grid. So it's not just a U.S. grid. It includes Canada. And they're all wired together except for Texas, which has got its own independent
Texas. Why is that, Texas, by the way? Texas
grid.
Just came about that way?
It just pretty much came about that way. There are regional entities that manage and try to coordinate these various grids, and Texas decided, you know, decades ago that they wanted to be on their own based on.
So these are interlocking grid systems.
Yes.
Regional systems.
Right.
For the flow of electricity.
That's right.
And electricity flows through these cables pretty much, above ground and below ground?
That's right. There are extra high voltage transformers. They are called EHV transformers. Big transformers, the size of a house that weigh hundreds of tons. There's about 2,000 of them in the North American grid. And most people don't know it, but these are the foundation stones of our modern electronic civilization. We cannot survive as a society without them. They enable us to take electricity from Niagara Falls, for example, and drive it all the way down to New York City, where there's another big transformer at the end of the line that steps that down so it can be used locally. The transformers were invented in this country by Nikola Tesla. In fact, all the technology associated with the grid was invented by Tesla in New York, near Niagara Falls. He built the first grid in the world, and we exported the technology all over the world. Unfortunately, like so many things, we don't make fundamental elements of the electric grid in this country anymore. The transformers aren't manufactured in the United States anymore. We have to import them from South Korea or Germany. And if these transformers were destroyed, it would basically end us as a civilization. They cannot be mass-produced. Each one has to be made individually by hand. The global production...
You said there's thousands of them.
2,000 of them, 2,000. Yes. 2,000 of
them. Do we have an inventory of them, and backup sources for them within our own country?
We have a small number of replacement transformers, less than 1% in reserve. And in part, that's because it's so difficult to replace them. They weigh so much and they're so big. There's only 3 railway cars in the whole country that can move an EHV transformer. Bridges have to be reinforced. Roads have to be widened. And that's assuming that the society is intact and you haven't lost other parts of the infrastructure, as would be the case in the aftermath of a catastrophic EMP. The worldwide capability to produce EHV transformers is only 200 a year. The whole world can make 200 EHV transformers.
So, and how many are there worldwide, do you know?
Oh, there's probably 10,000 worldwide, and if this country were to lose half of these EHV transformers, it would take the whole world 5 years to manufacture enough of them, assuming the whole world was not in a blackout, okay, but everything else was working. And I don't think South Korea and Germany and the Chinese and the Russians would be so generous in the aftermath of a natural EMP. That's why it's not just... The way of the think of these dangerous blackouts that we're talking about, they're not temporary blackouts. When you lose EHV transformers and the control systems, another piece of technology that is fundamental to our civilization is called the SCADA, the Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition System. It's a control system that also runs everything. Both of these things are vulnerable to EMP, and if you lose them, that's it for us.
Well, let's talk about this.
Okay, so that was a little bit of a rundown on our electrical grid. And as you can see, it's all privately owned because that's how we do things in America. It's not owned or run by a federal government. And the key components are these EHVs, these very, very large transformers. And we've probably seen them around, driving around, just never paid much of attention to them. But there's, you know, what did he say, 3,000 of them in the world. And to replace even half of them, if there was some kind of an EMP event, it could take 5 years. And then, like he said, that would only be if everyone in the world was willing to put that 5 years just to replacing ours. If something happened to the rest of other countries that make these things, they're not going to be able to produce them. And even if they were to jury-rig things and get it kind of running to where they could produce them, they're going to start producing their own and get themselves back online to where then they can start manufacturing these a little quicker. So you're really looking at, you know, maybe 10 years in the real type situation that we would be in if this happened. And then, like you said, there's other components like the stators and stuff, these control systems that, you know, run it all. And if you've ever talked to anybody that works for a large power generating company, even if it's just, you know, somebody that works in the operating room or operations or whatever they call that, will tell you that, you know, they have a hard time even dealing with solar power when you have solar power on your house and you're tied to the grid and maybe getting some kind of rebate for the extra power you create. Because electricity is one of those things when it's produced, it just goes out and then it's gone. It doesn't sit around and wait for the next place to be used. And so when you're producing solar power and you're tied into the grid, then there's less demand on the system and they're monitoring that and turning down the generator basically to where they're not making electricity that is basically just being wasted. So these control systems, these stators, are not just going, oh, that generator's running fine and the bearings aren't getting hot. It actually monitors, you know, down to basically your air conditioner. And when there's more of a demand, less of a demand, they have to crank up the output of their, I guess, their grid to meet that, but not to go so high to where they're wasting electricity or producing more than is needed at any given moment in time. So one guy I talked to that we work for actually does that. And he says it's actually really complicated and they got tons of data streams coming in all the time to where they can kind of keep it set to where if they need, you know, 100 watts, they produce 100 watts. If they need 50 watts, then they only produce 50. Now we're talking gigawatts with these companies, but you can kind of see it becomes very precise, you know, about how much liquid they're pouring in to exactly how much liquid is coming out of the bucket, if you look at it that way. So, you know, they don't want to be pouring in 10 gallons of liquid into a bucket when only 2 gallons is coming out, because then you have an overflow. But you don't want to be pouring in 2 gallons when 5 is coming out, because then you have shortages and brownouts. So it's very complicated, and these systems would also be affected because they're so electronically driven with the data streams and the managing of it on a macro level almost, that those would crash. And so even if we got the EHVs replaced in a short period of time, you know, that would be fine, because then we could turn on a factory and then maybe start making components that run these stators. So you can see just how big of a clusterfuck this would be. So let's listen to a little bit more of Mark Levin and see what other good news he can bring to the subject of could this happen and the feasibility of something like this actually happening in America.
From time to time in our country, we read a state or a city that's without electricity for a few days.
Yes.
Maybe a tree has fallen and hit a particular generator or something, that generator blows up, things like that happen. And then they're able to put it back together in a relatively short period of time. But you can see even right there, 3, 4, 5 days, there's really a panic in place and so forth. And what you're saying is, imagine this nationwide.
Right.
And when you start to think of electricity, everything we do is associated with electricity, isn't it? Even if you try and fill up your car, the gas station, the pump, electricity. Everything we do is related to electricity, no?
Absolutely. All the critical infrastructures depend upon it. Communications, transportation, banking, and finance. We did an experiment on the commission, and I went to a grocery store and picked up an apple. And I wondered, how did this apple get to this grocery store in the Washington, D.C. area? And the simple apple. And tracing the history of that apple, it turns out it was grown in an orchard in Washington. It was harvested mechanically. It was cleaned and packaged mechanically using electronic systems and electronic assembly belts. It was put on a refrigerated truck and then drove across the country so that people locally in Washington, D.C. could eat the apple. So even the simple apple depends upon hundreds of electronic systems in order to deliver it to us. And we wouldn't have the apple or any other food. In fact, there's only a 30-day food supply in the country to feed 320 million people. And water would stop immediately. You know, when you turn on the tap, it requires millions of volts in order to deliver that water through your tap. And the commission couldn't figure out how would we keep 320 million people alive, with no food, no water, possibly for years. We estimate that if we had a blackout in this country that lasted 1 year, and that's entirely possible in these scenarios that we're talking about, we could lose up to 90% of our population to starvation, disease, and societal collapse.
Hospitals wouldn't be able to function.
Hospitals wouldn't be able to get to hospital. That's right. You know, the most fundamental things wouldn't work anymore. In the case of a nuclear EMP attack, your car, you know, could be fried. Airplanes would fall out of the sky. Nuclear reactors would go Fukushima. We've got 100 nuclear reactors in this country. And they need electricity in order to keep themselves cool.
What do you say to people who say, this sounds like a grand conspiracy, this sounds like fear-mongering? Mm-hmm. You probably get this all the time.
Of course.
You probably got it from the Obama administration.
So as you can see, it's not even that easy to get power working for people when there's just a standard power outage. And a tree falls down and takes out some power lines that causes an overvoltage and the transformer blows up or something like that. So it just gets more and more complicated the more and more technologically advanced we become. And so how do we deal with it? We know it could happen. We understand that it can happen. And unless you're really living in denial, you have to consider this as a possible factor in your EMP or your end of the world or TIAWAKI or SHTF planning, because it is very real. And I don't think any of our leaders really pay much attention to this. They've been dicking around with the EMP commission for years. So I'm not thinking this is top of mind with our leaders. And I'm not just picking on one of them in particular or another one or one party as opposed to another. I think they've all been living under a rock or in a cave when it comes to EMPs. And so let's see just what it is that maybe our government is trying to do or not doing to keep us safe from these things.
Yes, we did.
What did the Obama administration do in response to these scenarios?
Well, the Obama administration, to its credit, at least it took solar EMP seriously enough that they formed a task force to study the problem endlessly. But they didn't even want to hear about nuclear EMP. And the chairman
nuclear
of
nuclear EMP is a nuclear event that wipes out the grid.
That's right.
Or a big chunk of it.
You know, with a nuclear weapon detonated at high altitude. It's the kind of thing that if Iran got the bomb, it could do it. If North Korea's got the bomb now, and it knows about EMP and has threatened to do it to us. And that's exactly why the Obama administration didn't want to know or hear about nuclear EMP. They wouldn't even meet with the chairman of our commission, Dr. William Graham, who's really the world's foremost expert on this. I mean, he was actually one of the people that discovered the EMP phenomenon back in the 1962 Starfish Prime test when I was in elementary school. Imagine not meeting with someone like Dr. William Graham. It would be like not meeting with Albert Einstein when he's trying to warn you that the Nazis could develop this thing called the atomic bomb back in 1939. And in effect, that's how irresponsible the Obama administration was, shutting the door on the Albert Einstein of EMP, who was Dr. William Graham, not listening to him, not following in at the recommendations of his commission. And in fact, when the commission was reestablished by Congress, Obama holdovers in the Department of Defense did everything they could to sabotage and undermine our work.
Why?
EMP did not fit into the narratives that they had for trying to sell two of the Obama administration's major policy objectives. You know, one was the idea of a world without nuclear weapons. They were trying to convince the world that nuclear weapons don't have any utility. You know, you need hundreds of them. You'd never be able to compete with the United States. That's not true. Any nation that gets just one bomb because of EMP, you know, basically becomes a nuclear superpower that could threaten the existence of the United States. So it didn't fit into the narrative of a world without nuclear weapons. And it didn't fit into the narrative about the Iran nuclear deal. If Iran had just one bomb, okay, you know, that would defeat the whole purpose of the Iran nuclear deal, because they wouldn't need dozens or hundreds of bombs. And the verification provisions, which are so poor on the Iran nuclear deal, would become a mortal threat to the existence of the United States. I and other specialists actually think Iran has already got the bomb and has probably had one for some years and the capability to do it, to do an EMP attack. And this is something the Obama administration didn't want known, didn't want to talk about.
When we come back, I'm going to ask Dr. Pry, well, what do we do about this?
Well, that's nice to know that, you know, one of our presidents, even though I wasn't a fan of Obama, that he was concerned about the effects of a solar EMP, or kind of like what happened with the Carrington event. But it saddens me to know that any of our leaders are ignoring the fact that this is a possibility because it maybe distracts from the conversation of a deal like the Iran deal, to where they don't want to talk about the use of nuclear weapons. So let's just pretend that we don't have them, or we don't have enough of them, or they can't attack us because we have more than them. Because we got past mutually assured destruction during the Cold War. No sane country that would have as many warheads as we do in the United States would use them, because then everyone dies. And I don't know, Iran might not care, you know, if all their people die, but I'm sure there's an argument to be made that they probably wouldn't want all their children killed either. So I'm saddened that our politicians are just playing politics as usual. You know, the old expression, you don't want to see how the sausage is made. And no, I don't. And that's part of Washington, D.C. politics, is they're given freedom and latitude within the kitchen to make sausage. But we have every right to assume that they're not going to poison that sausage as they're making it. And this is kind of what they're doing when they keep us in the dark. And that's not why we pay our politicians, no matter if they're the president of the United States. They work for us. And it might scare us, and it might make us a little sad, and we might get a little queasy in the stomach. But the reality is, if there's a threat, we have every right to know about it, be told about it, and have this discussion openly. And then if people want to panic, fine, let them panic. People panic all the time. So it's disheartening. And then to think that, well, maybe they're not worried about this because they have alternatives. Maybe we have some kind of defenses against this, or maybe we're hardened. And in this interview, he doesn't go into as much as I would like as far as super EMPs. But yes, our military has hardened equipment up to, I think, 50 million or 500,000 watts per meter or something like that. But super EMPs can create twice that. And so once again, they don't want to talk to us about it. They want to sit there and go, well, their North Korea's warheads cannot survive reentry. So, oh, don't worry about it. Nothing to see here. Move along. Don't panic. But when it's detonated because it's part of a satellite, then it just detonates at that altitude. It doesn't need to do reentry. In fact, the altitude of that type of weapon is higher than reentry altitudes. So there would be no reentry. It just detonates at 300 miles up and lights out. They could even drop it for 100 miles to where it gets a little closer if they wanted to pinpoint some damage. And still it hasn't got to the altitude of reentry. So those temperatures are irrelevant. But that's all fear-mongering. Let's see if our government has anything in the works, and maybe they're just not, once again, telling us about it as far as protection against this type of device.
Dr. Peter Pry, what would be, before we get to the question of how do we protect ourselves, the question is we need to figure out how we might be attacked. So what are the different scenarios out there? I'm sure there are many in which a country might want to shut down our electrical grid.
North Korea could shut down our grid by an EMP attack off a satellite. They, in fact, have two satellites orbiting over this country as we speak. They're passed over us several times a day that are at the optimum altitude to evade our national missile defenses and to make an EMP field that would cover North America.
How would they make an EMP field?
They would detonate the satellite when it's over the center of the country, and the field, you know, would propagates from the location of the warhead to the line of sight.
So there'd have to be a satellite with a warhead.
There'd have to be a satellite with a warhead.
Can they do that?
They could. They could. And we're not sure that these satellites are not already nuclear armed. The EMP Commission is very concerned that they may be. And we have recommended that these satellites be shot down because the risk to the country is just too great to take to take the chance. They could do it with an ICBM, although our national missile defenses, you know, would have a reasonable chance of intercepting the ICBM.
Now, if the North Koreans can do that with satellites, I assume the Chinese and the Russians are far ahead of them, and they could easily do that.
Certainly. And Vladimir Putin actually threatened that recently about doing what's called launching an ICBM on a south polar trajectory, which is the trajectory that North Korean satellites fly on, a south polar trajectory.
Why would they do it that way as opposed to this way?
Because we don't have any ballistic missile early warning radars facing south, and we don't have any interceptors facing south. We're blind and defenseless
now,
from that direction. Because during the Cold War, we assumed the attacks would come from the Soviet Union over the North Pole, which is the shortest distance.
Yeah.
It's the shortest distance to our missile fields and our bomber bases. And, unfortunately, we have left that flank unprotected. There are ideas and recommendations we've made for trying to, in a hurry, close this gap in our defenses. They could also do it by launching a balloon or a short-range missile off of a ship, off of a freighter. You know, North Korea actually had a freighter with a nuclear-capable missile in the Gulf of Mexico back in 2013. We only found out about that because they tried getting back through the Panama Canal, and we found two of these missiles hidden under hundreds of bags of sugar on this freighter. Fortunately, they didn't have a nuclear weapon on it, but it demonstrated their ability to get a freighter with a nuclear-capable missile into our backyard, and we didn't even know about it. So those are some of the nuclear EMP attack scenarios in terms of how you might do it. But there are other ways of attacking the grid, too, and all of these other ways would be part of this new way of warfare that Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran have all conceived and have as part of their war plan that includes cyber attacks on the grid. You could take the grid down with cyber attacks. That includes physical sabotage.
On the cyber attacks, hasn't Russia been poking around already?
Russia, North Korea, China, and Iran, all of them have been poking around already. And our reaction as a society has been very disappointing, especially during the Obama administration. The Chinese stole tens of millions of records from the Office of Personnel Management in one cyber attack. In another cyber attack, the Russians shut down the Internet for the Joint Chiefs of Staff that was dedicated to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and interfered with White House Internet communications as well for about a week. You know, at the time, there's a big scandal in the press. People talk about it in Congress. Then time passes and people kind of forget about it.
So that was nice to hear that we know it can happen. It's no big mystery. Our enemies have the capability. That shouldn't be a mystery. And then when these things happen, even with like cyber attacks, it gets talked about. And then we, the people, kind of tend to forget about it because we have this news cycle mentality to where whatever's new and happening becomes the new thing we're talking about. And we forget all about what happened just yesterday. So that's not completely, as a people, our fault. We have a news media that pretty much just blows everything off, or they spin it, or they basically put the carrot on a stick and start steering us into another direction to where now we're talking about something else. And it's not that as a concerned group of people that we may be, don't care. It's just other things start filling the void and taking our attention elsewhere. And that's where, as preppers, we become aware of a threat. And then we maintain a certain threat level or concern about that, and then start prepping for that one thing we heard about. But it seems like a lot of us don't want to believe that this would be possible. So maybe, and I'm just saying maybe, we might allow our normalcy bias toward the lack of concern for an EMP type attack to just lull us into some other scenario that we prepare for. I feel that being prepared for any kind of scenario makes you prepared for all types of scenarios, but I'm kind of a loner when it comes to that way of thinking. So I'm sure he's going to talk a little bit about, you know, what kind of threats we're preparing for as a nation when it comes to cyber and all this. But keep in mind that our government is going to continue to use the news to take our eye off the ball and keep us, you know, chasing the red meat of the news cycle.
What people need to understand is that what these probing are, let me use an analogy going back to history. Before World War II, there was another new way of warfare that Nazi Germany came up with called the Blitzkrieg. It was a combined arms operation that combined armor with fast moving infantry and mobile artillery and air power. And part of this blitzkrieg strategy was they had a motorcycle corps. So the motorcycles would range out in front of the armored spearheads and in front of the air power, looking for weaknesses in the enemy lines. And that's kind of what these cyber attacks are now. They're the equivalent of a German motorcyclist sitting on a hill, looking out over your lines to see where is the weakness and how are we going to respond. They're gauging our responses as all part of this. And we don't seem to get that we're actually under attack now by these cyber attacks, because behind those cyber attacks is the possibility of physical sabotage by commandos, non-nuclear EMP weapons, so-called radio frequency weapons that can also use EMP to black out electric grids and the like, all of them in combination with the ultimate cyber weapon, because in Russia, China, North Korean, Iranian doctrine, a nuclear EMP attack is not a nuclear attack, it's a cyber attack, okay? And the big stick would be this nuclear EMP attack that caps all of this. They could take us down by any one of these ways, but the combination of it is irresistible. Just like the Blitzkrieg that the German Nazi Germany came up with was irresistible and nearly defeated the Western democracies in World War II. I fear this time, if we are not prepared and don't protect our systems, there'll be no coming back from it. And the bad guys would win. In their doctrine, they could replace one civilization with another in the span of 24 hours. The war would be over in 24 hours.
We have the ability to do this to our adversaries and enemies as well, correct?
On this one, I wasn't a very big fan on the Blitzkrieg analogy, but when you really think about it, I guess it does make sense. When a country is probing for weaknesses and such. What I did find kind of fascinating about this, and I'd heard it in another one of his interviews, to where the world, and a big part of it anyway, under their doctrine, meaning Russia, China, some of the bigger players, do not consider an EMP attack as a nuclear attack. They look at it more as a type of cyber attack, even though it's not like a hacker breaking into your email account cyber attack. But they look at it as this shuts off our ability to be connected that way on the internet. And so they're looking at it more as there's no real loss of life through an EMP. It just destroys our cyber abilities, I guess, is the way to perceive what they're thinking as people. So we are very vulnerable that way. And how do you counter-strike in that aspect when all the big players in NATO and all this would be going, well, no, they didn't drop nuclear bombs on you, so it's not a nuclear attack, so you cannot respond nuclearly because it was just a cyber attack. So that's the big takeaway from what he was just saying that a lot of people might not have caught. So let's listen to some more and see if we have any ability to strike back.
Well, launching a missile, a nuclear missile, exploding it above a particular country and so forth, do we?
We have the capability, not as good as the Russians and Chinese and North Koreans have. They have probably developed what we call super EMP weapons. Okay? They're nuclear weapons specially designed for EMP. The United States has neglected its nuclear forces, and we haven't deployed that kind of warhead. Now, we have warheads. You can really use any warhead to do an EMP attack. So we could. We've got cyber offensive capabilities. We've got physical sabotage capabilities.
Do we prepare for these things the way our enemies do?
I wish we did.
In terms of offensive capability?
Yeah. I wish we did. I don't know whether we do or not. I suspect we don't. The reason I suspect we don't is because we haven't even protected ourselves from the enemy's offensive capabilities. And if we understood and had put it together and ourselves had mastered this new way of warfare and were prepared to execute it, I would have to believe that we would have taken the common sense precautions to protect ourselves, but we haven't.
Are committees of Congress, the defense committees, the intelligence committees, are they aware of this grave threat that you're talking about? They must be, right?
They are.
Do they take it seriously?
Some members of Congress do, and actually I should say that the Congress as a whole does. The EMP Commission was reestablished. It was done so unanimously. Senator Ron Johnson, who was the chairman of the Senate Homeland Security Committee, passed a really important bill in 2016 called the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act, which directed the Department of Homeland Security to start planning, preparing to protect our country from natural and nuclear EMP. So Congress takes it seriously. I wish they would take it more seriously. One of the things that was done in the not serious category is Congress decided to close down the EMP Commission at the end of September, in the very month that North Korea successfully tested a hydrogen bomb that the North Koreans described as designed for super powerful EMP attack. It makes no sense to do that. You know, the commission should have continued if you're right. Going to be really serious about this.
Okay, well, that was thrilling to hear. It's nice to know that Congress is on board with, let's just say, 90% of, figuring this out. So I guess the other players in government aren't on board, which is not how it works in our society. We have three branches of government. We have the executive, which is the president, and he just signs things into law and makes sure those laws are kept, because he's basically the chief law enforcement for federal laws and stuff like that and treaties. And then we have the courts, which would be the Supreme Court might rule on something and come up with an opinion on that. But they only come up with opinions. They're not really supposed to rule because they're not rulers. We did away with that form of government 200 plus years ago when we created a constitutional government. So really the key players would be Congress. You elect your neighbor, Bob. You know him. You went to school with him. He goes to the state capitol. They get together. They discuss and hash things out. With other congressmen from other areas that might be farming areas or ranching or logging or mining areas. And then they come to some kind of agreement to where how these rules should be, enacted. And then they would appoint senators, and senators were just the delivery boys that would go to Washington and tell the president, yes, no, yes, yes, no. And then they would come home. Well, now we've created a fourth branch of government, which is called the Senate, and they want to blather on endlessly about what they think. Well, that's not how it works in a representative republic like America. I don't really care what anyone thinks. A congressman is supposed to do what we think. And the senators seem to now think, because they're elected for 6 years, that they have an opinion. So I guess this is the battle that we now fight. Because Congress is on board with protecting our ass against an EMP, but I guess Senate and lawyers and judges and lobbyists aren't, who are not elected, and they don't represent we the people. So it's sad, and this is part of the problem with America, even though we don't see it, but we weren't paying attention when these stupid amendments were passed that made senators get elected. So now they think they're a fourth branch of government and their opinion matters. So they're mucking up the ointment and screwing with our ability to be safe and secure in our homes and on our property. So we should be thinking about that as a threat, as preppers, just going, hey, wait a minute, this is not the way it's supposed to work. But unfortunately, it is the way it works. So we have an issue, we have EMP threat, and now we have people in Washington on different pages reading different books. So let's see what else is going on in the world of EMPs.
All right, Dr. Pry, now what can we do to defend ourselves?
There's really no excuse for the United States to be vulnerable to EMP or cyber catastrophes that bring down the grid or physical sabotage. You know, all of them can be protected against if you protect against the worst threat, which is the nuclear EMP attack. And we've known how to do that for 50 years. The Department of Defense has been protecting military systems for 50 years using surge arresters and blocking devices. And we can do in Faraday cages. And we can do the same thing.
What's a Faraday cage?
It's basically a metal box that encloses a structure that keeps the EMP from getting in and getting at the electronics. Air Force One is a gigantic flying Faraday cage.
So in other words, it defends against these electromagnetic attacks.
Yes, that's right.
It keeps, on whatever is under it.
That's right. It keeps the electronics inside safe. And we can do the same thing for the electric grid. And it wouldn't even be that expensive. The EMP Commission estimated it would cost $2 to $3 billion to protect the whole national
grid. $2 to $3 billion for the entire grid?
Yes, the entire national grid, which is what we used to give away in foreign aid to Pakistan every year. until President Trump fortunately stopped that that exercise. But if we took that foreign aid to Pakistan and spent it on the security of the American
people. I don't understand. They spend over $4 trillion a year.
Yes.
The GAO reports that we waste anywhere from $125 to $250 billion a year.
That's right.
$2 to $3 billion a year, that's mustard money for the federal government.
I agree.
I'm not talking down the money. I'm saying that as far as the federal government goes, that's a pittance. Is there a reason why that's not slipped into these omnibus bills?
Yes. There's the electric power industry doesn't want to do anything against the EMP, and they have very deep pockets. They own half of K Street. They lobby against bills. There's also a problem.
Well, why wouldn't they? It would destroy their entire industry.
I know, but the idea that that
they don't believe it's going to happen.
Many of them, they are not experts on EMP, okay, and they don't see their jobs and their right as being national and homeland security. They see that as the job of the federal government, and they also want to have a regulatory environment such as exists now, where in effect the electric power industry is the last critical infrastructure that regulates itself, and we have many examples from history where industries have put themselves out of business or done things that have seriously harmed their customers, you know, because they haven't seen it is in their interests to do so. For example, the Zeppelin industry convinced itself that it could fly people around in hydrogen gas balloons safely if they just exercised the right operational procedures. But had there been a Federal Aviation Administration back in the 1920s, we might still have Zeppelin.
But to me, this is even more compelling because we're not talking about regulating taxing them, doing these sorts of things. We're talking about protecting the grid in order to protect the American people. It's a national security issue.
Yes, I quite agree. It is a national security issue. But the electric power industry, I mean, the bad guy in this scenario is called the NERC, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. They're not engineers. They're not technicians. They're mostly lawyers at the top. And they see their job as to avoid having to do anything that the feds want to impose upon them in terms of protecting from EMP or cyber, even the tree branch threat. The Great Northeast Blackout was caused by a tree branch that contacted a power line back in 2003 and put 50 million Americans in the dark. It took them a decade of foot dragging before they finally, allegedly, did something to improve our security against
the
tree branch threat.
If the federal government said this is part of infrastructure, you know, they want to spend $1.5 trillion on infrastructure. $1.5 trillion.
You're reading my mind.
Okay. And if they, we haven't talked about this. And
no.
if they say, you know what, let's put $2 or $3 billion aside for this.
Exactly. That's one of the EMP Commission's recommendations in the reports that we've put forward in our advice when we have briefed the National Security Council that EMP protection should be made part of the infrastructure renewal program. And one of the things that we need is an executive agent at the level of the White House, somebody responsible for protecting the national grid and the other critical infrastructures too, from EMP, cyber, from all these threats we've been talking about. Because the chief problem is nobody is in charge of protecting the critical infrastructures. We've never thought about that.
So what would we do for $2 or $3 billion?
We would install Faraday cages and blocking devices and surge arrestors on the transformers, for example. You can put a surge arrestor on the transformer, just like you've got a surge arrestor on your personal computer to protect it from lightning. You can have a specially designed surge arrestor that will protect against lightning, against nuclear EMP, against the EMP from the sun. And had we done so, it would protect you against all of these worst-case scenarios, not just nuclear EMP and cyber.
Okay, well, it appears that there's usually a little bit more debate on whether these Faraday cages and stuff would actually protect our EHBs and the status systems that he was talking about earlier in the interview with Mark Levin. But let's just say that the Faraday cage is protected, or the surge arrestors protected the larger transformers, the EHBs, then that puts us ahead of the curve, at least, if there was a massive EMP. Holy crap. You know, so that would be a good thing, that we're not going hat in hand to our enemies and trying to get these rebuilt, because who knows, you know, how affected their economies will be, and they might not be putting us at the head of the list of getting this shit done. But a lot of the things that they don't talk about in this interview, and probably not even the EMP Commission itself, is sure the grid itself might be okay. but the surge itself is airborne, and it's a field. And so you protect the big transformer, but it's still going to run through the power lines, the high voltage lines that run across the country. And whether that transformer's been shut off by a surge arrestor or not, the lines are still going to melt. A lot of the smaller transformers in your neighborhood, the things up on the poles, they're going to be, you know, exploding left and right, not because the power's coming from these big transformers, but because it's just airborne, basically. It's just going everywhere. So your house is not going to work, and none of the stuff outside your house is going to work. And so you're still going to have years of chaos while they're trying to rebuild all that. And that's the one thing that is never discussed, is the cascading effect from the lines melting and most of your cars not working, the newer cars and your electronics and the internet itself and the servers maybe were not protected in a certain area, or the cell towers just caught fire because they might have been protected, but the overvoltage in the air, you know, burned them up. So they're not looking at some of the peripheral things that could happen and probably would happen with that type of voltages coming out of a super EMP or a solar flare. You know, a CME is way more powerful than these nuclear EMP weapons. So they're not looking at the smaller things. You know, you might not need to kill something completely. If you pull off all its limbs, it's still not going to be a threat anymore. And that's what they would do to America. And I think they know that. And then anything that's still maybe up and running, then they could turn around and hit us with the cyber and kill the rest of our internet that might still be working. So they're not looking at that. Now, one of the points he made was, you know, earlier on, is that the power grid is not publicly run. It's private. And I'm amazed at how few problems we do have with our power grid in comparison to all these infrastructure projects that our government seems to run, like our freeway systems and air traffic control and all these things. So I'm not a big fan of having it be government run. I'm kind of happy that it's privately owned. I do think an oversight committee might make some sense to these engineers and lawyers he was talking about. You know, these lawyers and stuff are looking at the bottom line and they're not seeing threats that might put them out of business. So I think a committee would be good to go, hey, we got the money. Why don't you do this? We're going to show you how to do it. And, you know, it's a gift from the taxpayers. What do you care? But they're fighting against it because, as most arguments with the government, they frame their argument in a way to where they want to be in control when all is said and done. And these lawyers and these agencies that are publicly run don't want that to happen. So I can see both sides of the argument. I think having an oversight committee would be good, especially in this day and age with what we have as far as this type of threat on our power grid. But don't think that just because these transformers survive that you and I are going to survive, because you know, he's kind of going back to a point where we protected these big transformers. So, well, it's happy days are here again? No. You know, the power lines outside of your house are burning and on fire. Your house may be on fire because of the oversurge. So even if it's not, you're not going to be able to use your phone or your computer and your laptop, because they're going to definitely be fried. And anything you had in a Faraday cage might work. Once you get it out and fired up, but what's it going to connect to? Cell towers are all burned up and on fire. You know, police stations aren't going to be responding to, you know, emergency calls because their cars aren't running. Their radios might not be working because they're not hardened like the federal governments are. So, you know, the communications tower on your local police department or firehouse is on fire, you know, and so they're not factoring this in. But we know it's a threat. You can, you know, put your head in the sand and go, EMPs aren't real, la, 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 la. But they are. This guy is an expert on it. That's why I left the introduction on there. And it doesn't mean we have to freak out and scream around, you know, the sky is falling, the complete opposite of ignoring the problem. But there is a problem. There is a threat. It's real. It can happen. Our enemies can do it. So now we just have to get our head around the fact that our government's not going to be able to completely protect us. The power grid will not be totally protected for years if they even do any of this stuff he's talking about. So we have to be ready to just go back to the 1800s and live in that kind of lifestyle for a while. And I don't think it would be a bad thing because, you know, in the 1800s, they had homes and dinner and children and families and schools. So they were just not doing it with the internet and smartphones and all that fun shit that we have nowadays. Let's listen to some more and see if we can gain any more information from this guy.
But also severe weather like the hurricanes, millions of people or hundreds of thousands of people who were made homeless for months by Hurricane Sandy would have been able to go home earlier if the electric grid had been hardened against nuclear EMP, because it would have been able to survive the overvoltages that happened during Hurricane Sandy as a result of high power lines getting knocked down and transformers and SCADAs being damaged. If you can survive the worst threat, the nuclear EMP attack, you'll be able to come back much more quickly from any of these lesser threats. So it's not just for the rare, you know, exotic scenario of a terrorist nuclear EMP attack. It would improve the security of American people from things that happen every year: tornadoes, hurricanes, ice storms that cause blackouts. And you don't have to be a physicist to see the grid is at risk. You know, if you just look at the history of blackouts and the long recovery times that are required after these hurricanes, you can see there's something wrong. Look at Puerto Rico. You know, Puerto Rico is still not recovered as a result of the hurricane that went through there. You know, clearly, if something like Puerto Rico is going to absorb all the emergency resources of the continental United States to get its recovery, we're going to be in huge trouble if a nuclear EMP takes down the national grid.
Incredible.
We've got to do better.
Yeah. Don't forget, just a reminder, you can join us every weeknight on Levin TV on Conservative Review TV, our digital TV network. Just give us a buzz, 844-LEVIN-TV, and join us. That's 844-LEVIN-TV.
Okay, well, that about wraps this up on EMP, the possibility, the science, and the reality of it. I left the intro and everything on Mark Levin's interview, so kind of to give him credit. Because it was a very informative interview, and I thought it would be nice just to play the whole thing and put in a little bit of side thoughts here and there. So thanks to Mark Levin and definitely Dr. Peter Pry for doing this interview. I think it was fantastic and very informative. We can pretend all we want that it's not real, but I think after listening to this, there are people out there that can prove that it's real. It can happen. It's not conspiracy. It's just new science that we're unfamiliar with, but that doesn't make it any less real. So be prepared for EMP or any other kind of tee out walkie, shit hit the fan kind of thing, and you'll be fine. And this is just more information to help you be prepared for the end of times. It's not that overwhelming. If you can survive, you can survive. It won't matter what happened that ended your world as you knew it. It happened. So all you can do is survive and keep your family alive. I hope you guys all enjoyed this, and I will talk to you later.
Well, I want to thank you for tuning in and listening to this show. I hope I brought something to the table for you all. As always, go to prepperguy.com. Read the show notes and run over to YouTube. Check out my channel every once in a while. I'll have a video out there, and sometimes I do the whole episode as a video. Other than that, I hope you have a great week, and we will talk to you later. As always, enjoy the apocalypse.